the Dalai Lama is reputed to have said, when asked if he could teach people about either emptiness or karma, kind of two of the big Buddhist topics, where emptiness is the one that feels like deep and mysterious and wisdom-oriented, he said that karma was the more important. And what he points to is the centrality of this particular teaching on karma. Karma literally means action within the Buddhist system, but also the way that, not just as a central teaching, but actually the observations on karma are the central observation around how the universe works, how actually the vast ecosystem, which includes us and conscious beings, functions. And seeing the operations of karma and conditionality, and I'll begin to unpack those a little bit tonight, was directly the thing that the Buddha saw on the mythical or you know, captured in a mythic format, night of his awakening. The core insights that liberate in this system are insights into cause and effect, essentially. Like that the universe is a lawful system, is an ordered system that is vastly complex, but within that complexity can be understood through this particular lens. And the lens is a lens that brings together an understanding of time, of action, of the self, of relationship, of interaction and interdependence between beings. All of this contained within this teaching of karma. The word karma literally means just action. Kr is the root to act or make or do, and is, you know, one of the absolutely most central verbs, of course, in the language, right? What's more central than doing? You know, being is the other one. The I am is the other most central. In almost every language, these two are a kind of pair, right? And even in Sanskrit grammar, the word kra is the grammatical term for the two most important parts of the sentence, where the kartar, so it's the same root, kra, the kartar is the one who does an action, and the karman, again, same root, is the one who receives the action. So if I place the cup on the floor, I'm the karman, the one doing the placing, and the floor is the... I'm the karter, the one doing the action, and the floor is the karman, the one receiving the action, or the cup, depending on grammatically how you construct the sentence. So in its earliest religious or spiritual or you know, almost cosmological use in the Vedas, the word karma, action, originally starts to be used really in relation to the action of doing the ritual chanting that is part of the fire sacrifice. So if we were, you know, if we were ancient Indian Brahmins, or if some of us were Brahmins, you know, if one of you was the Brahmin priest and the rest of us were, you know, householders of some kind, and we were doing a fire sacrifice, the priest or priests, often several, would be doing a certain set of chants and invocations, prayers, along with offerings. And the action of doing the offering and the chanting is karma. So you can take this word then and you start to abstract it, right? It doesn't just mean action, but it means a ritual action. And what's the point of ritual action is that it has an effect. You know, this is the most important effect, in fact, in the entire culture, that this, the ritual sacrifice happens, precious substance, milk and ghee and butter and you know, grain, is offered into the fire, which is a god, Agni, is burnt, and in that action is transmuted into a subtle essence that rises to the sky and is the nourishment of the gods who are actually just the ecosystem. The Vedic gods are just the gods of the water and the wind and the sky and the earth and the fire and the rains, the storm. And so then action in its earliest usage in Indian thought, in its earliest religious usage, is like the action that keeps the ecosystem going. The one action that truly has results and that has to be done correctly in order to have correct results. And so then embedded in action is automatically the sense of its effectiveness or non-effectiveness. What, to flash into the mid-20th century, the speech theorist Austin would call like a certain action in the form of speech, which this originally was, the chanting. It could be you know, happy or infelicitous, unhappy, essentially, right? So like if I am doing a ritual chant and I say, you know, praise to the deity of the dawn, Usha, the dawn goddess, one of the most beloved of the Vedic goddesses, you know, homage to the dawn who brings light. Happiness or felicity or success in the saying of that and the doing of the offering would depend on, you know, things like whether my pronunciation was perfect, whether the offering was done in the correct order, whether the puja was set up correctly, whether the people of the right caste were present, all of the necessary conditions for the action to be successful. And when it was successful, then it would attain its result. So action and speech are intertwined, and usefulness or result are intertwined. So this deepens in Indian thought. And by the time we get to the Buddha, there's a wide range of ideas going around what karma is. And at the heart of the debate, and it really was a debate, there's sages that get mentioned in the texts on all sides of this debate. And some of those debate questions are things like, do actions matter? What would it mean for an action to matter? And embedded in that is the question, does anything happen to consciousness? There's clearly a thing called consciousness, as you can use that word to name the aspect of our experience that can be awake or can self-witness, or that can be aware of witnessing. I see the floor. I'm aware of seeing the floor. There's some quality present called awareness or consciousness of that. They notice that. They're like, okay, that's an amazing quality. And with that comes a whole host of things, like the sense of being a self in this body. So then the question arises, okay, it's clear that bodies die. What happens to that consciousness? Does it go on? Does it disperse into the ecosystem? Does it jump into another body? Does it just disappear into nothingness? Was it ever a thing to begin with? All of those questions were around. And if the result of an action, in part, is the result of that action on the experiences of that consciousness, like I do an action and I have an experience, you know, I spill the tea, I feel embarrassed, I have to clean it up, the studio gets mad at me, whatever happens, there's a result that I can perceive in relation to an action that I do. If my consciousness or my sense of self or ever anything having to do with the one who could perceive the results of spilling the tea now, if that consciousness doesn't do anything after I die, it would be difficult to philosophically assert that actions really mattered in a long-term sense. Because no matter what I did during my life, I would just die and be done with it. And I wouldn't receive any benefit from doing good actions, and I wouldn't incur any harm from doing bad actions. And this is a position that the Buddha called nihilism and said this was categorically wrong view. This is not how it works. But it was one of the positions that was around at that time. And then lots of variations in between. You know, this kind of action matters, but this doesn't. Actions work in this way. Actions work in this way. you know, actions carry more energy than speech, which carries more energy than thought, or totally the other way around, thought carries the most energy, then speech, then action the least. The Buddha stepped in with a really particular spin on it. And this is still a bit contentious. It may be the case that that emphasizing this aspect of karma in the Buddha's teachings is the result of a historical preference among certain communities for a very specific, very small body of texts that has been blown into a big proportion. It's not entirely clear what the Buddha meant by karma throughout the course of his teaching. But here's the way it was taught to me, and this is the dominant view within my lineage, even as scholars are now scratching their heads and looking at parallel texts and getting confused, which is their job. But here's the teaching as it has come down to us, and does show up in a very important way in the Buddhist teachings, if small, that karma is defined essentially by intention, or to be more precise, volition. In other words, volition is that willful quality that accompanies doing something on purpose, right? I intend to pick up the tea, so I have a volitional reaching out of my arm. I did it on purpose. Versus if I'm sort of gesturing passionately with my arm and I happen to knock over the tea and I didn't do it on purpose, it was an accident. And let's say in the accident of spilling the tea, you know, an innocent ant passing by drowned. The teaching on intention in relation to karma that was very much elaborated, especially into the Chinese system and further out into some of the aspects of Buddhism that went into diaspora, whatever that means, see last week's talk on anatta, selflessness, but that karma, in the sense of a specific personal result of that action, is not incurred if it's an accident. And this is because the thing that really affects my experience going forward is really the effect of things that I chose to do. It's almost like saying your choices carry a lot more weight than the kind of accidental situations you end up in. Those can be very difficult, but the thing that will really hurt you in the long run is the things that you've done intentionally. What the Buddha comes out in saying then, and this is it may be that this was emphasized particularly as a way to differentiate from the Vedic stream or the other schools that were around. The Buddha says karma is basically ethical, and it's basically about your intention, your ability to perform ethical actions. Ethical actions are those that are wholesome and lead to further goodness. Unethical actions are unwholesome, they lead to further harm. All this is a way of saying that we can think of karma as a lens through which to understand the universe as intrinsically ethical. And that means that we can understand everything that matters to us as conscious beings directly as a consequence of ethical choices. And I say it that way, you know, as a way to say like, oh, like, do we understand, you know, an asteroid striking the planet as inherently ethical? And the system doesn't assert that. It's not that every situation is ethical. It's that the asteroids and planets don't need to be liberated in the same way that conscious beings do. They're already unconfused, essentially, unlike us. So they live in a non-ethical system. But the liberation of beings depends profoundly on ethics. It's actually the only thing that liberation depends on, ultimately. So then we come into our own lives and we say, okay, how does this impact me? What does this mean for me? And part of what it means is that we understand our lives as being, first of all, not random, not out of control, but actually as expressions of an orderly, if extremely complex system. And that system is a system of conditional relationship. Conditions is a way of saying everything has an effect, but there's many different things you could say, or the system of what has an effect in any given moment's consciousness is extremely complex. So it can't be simplified down to a one-to-one cause and effect. So when we say causes and conditions. So like, I'm here tonight partly because I fell in love with Buddhism, but I'm also here tonight partly because, you know, my toddler doesn't have a cold and bedtime was going okay. Like, and I'm partly here because, you know, because I didn't get an academic job in Schenectady that I applied for last year. And I'm partly here because, you know, my dad was from the Bronx and my mom, you know, had to give me up for adoption and I ended up in California. Like everything is a condition for this moment. Understanding that and saying, oh, that's right. So then there's sort of two aspects to pay attention to in this complex system. One is how we deal with the past. And the past essentially consists of memory. So not just thought, but thought and emotion and sensation and culture is as a kind of memory, etc. All of the momentum from the past. And then the other is how we deal with the future, which is essentially our own actions going forward. And the actions of all those we're connected to. The past conditions the present conditions the future, on and on forever. And beginningless. So this is also a system where there was no singular creator who said go on everything and, you know, flicked the dominoes and then, you know, settled back in the easy chair to watch it all unfold or whatever, intervene at specific moments. The model is actually more frightening than that. The model is actually that this is how it works since time immemorial. There's nothing other than this process going on. So I'm talking a little bit tonight about the past then. We'll get on to personal action and karma view soon. But here's a model of talking about the past. When we talk about trauma, we're talking about the past. When we talk about healing, we're talking about the past. There's all of these ways that so many of us come to practice. Essentially, if we could boil down our need or our impulse, it could boil down to something like, the past is unresolved in me. Something needs to be settled or understood or moved through or processed. And then the other half is, you know, based in what has happened, I'm not satisfied in this moment, what do I do going forward? And they always interweave, right? The process of doing healing is doing actions in the present that affect the future. But the gaze is turned back toward the past in many aspects of healing work. And the gaze turned back toward the past was the Buddha's first insight on his enlightenment evening. If you want to bring the box over, you totally can. And yeah, no one minds. You just don't sneeze on them. Looking into the past and understanding where he had come from, understanding his own ancestry, his families, his previous lives, was the first insight of the Buddha. It's the very first thing he does when his mind is gathered enough to approach liberation in a concrete way. So here's a model for understanding the past through the lens of karma. Here it is from the individual point of view. In your past, and let's just say within this lifetime to start with, and then go past that, further than that if you want. But within this lifetime, you have been subject to, or you've experienced, all sorts of experiences of different qualities. And in general, those experiences can be divided, using the basic ethical spectrum, into those that helped you and those that harmed you. And that doesn't mean that every single discrete experience is absolutely one of those. And so it's a spectrum. And I call this the trauma privilege spectrum. And it's a spectrum speaking to how, in a sense, many experiences we have are actually kind of mixed, you know? Like, school, I'm sure, helped a little bit. And, you know, was dreadful. And very often, almost the same thing, you know, almost in the same moment. And so it's a spectrum, meaning that our past is a deeply complex web of two kinds of things, or experiences that can be understood through this particular binary in a useful way. So trauma, in the kind of trauma resolution work and nervous system work that I do, and particularly within organic intelligence, is understood not as a singular event, like the particular bad things that happened to a being, but as the symptoms or effect of the past that remain in the present, whether that was of singular events or systemic forces or, you know, long-term accumulating events like attachment rupture or, you know, microaggression over time, many aspects of oppression. Trauma is a word for the condition of still bearing the pain or difficulty or having been affected in a painful way by past experience. So the condition for trauma is past danger and harm. Danger, settings that were dangerous, and then harm, direct harm caused, whether physical or emotional, psychic. The symptom of trauma then is pain and distress in the present. So, you know, maybe I was criticized a lot as a child, and in the present I have a kind of low self-esteem. Right? That would be a trauma symptom, where the criticism would be the traumatizing pattern or body of events. Present pain and distress. I use the word shadow to refer to the hidden qualities in anything. And so the shadow of trauma is that having pain in one's past often gives rise to qualities like strength and resilience or resourcefulness, and especially the resourcefulness of connection with others. This is especially true for systemic traumas like poverty, very often giving rise to a very different sense of communal belonging than the comfort of wealth, for instance, which can tend to be isolating. So the shadow being strength and resourcefulness, and the healing in trauma consisting in completion of the self-protective patterns and the impulses that are arising in relation to past trauma, and integration of those experiences in oneself. So integration, like the sense that I know that I can handle what comes at me, that I can be with difficult experience. And completion is shorthand for a larger topic, which in brief is something like having been put in situations where I needed to defend myself in the past, that defense lives in the musculature in the form of fight and flight. And one of the trauma symptoms is that I feel that fight and flight in the present, even though the threatening situation is long past. So then completion refers to actually completing those processes. This sounds really subtle, and it is for many of us. It's less subtle when it's in relation to like more intense, you know, sudden traumas. One of my friends led, was part of a team of therapists that went to China just after the Sichuan earthquake that killed so many and made homeless so many many years ago. And they were working with the children of a school that had collapsed. And my friend told this kind of amazing story of, you know, kind of one short session they were able to do with a little girl who was in profound shock She just, like, the glazed look, couldn't play, couldn't do anything. She would just sit in a chair all day, couldn't really move, you know, after the incredible shock of what had happened. And they were doing this work. They were doing therapeutic work first across a language barrier, which, and the child is like six, so there's a barrier anyway. And so they couldn't even say much, but they were just kind of casually chit-chatting and just being friendly and not doing anything. And my friend said that he just started to play with her feet. Mm-hmm. And he was just playing with her feet, and then the playing began, just started going back and forth. Like pushing the feet, 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 right? Push the feet, push the feet, push the feet, push the feet. Suddenly she bursts into tears, wailing, crying. So they hold her, and she just like wails and cries, and then stands up and says, bye, and runs out to play. And like, what? And in some, as a sort of hyper-simplistic answer, and I wish it was this simple for everyone who comes to my office, I'm like, just mobilize a little bit, I take it out of here, right? But, you know, the flight system manifests as muscular engagement in the legs, right? Of course, running away is the right thing to do when you're in a moment like that, right? But she was in shock. She was in that pattern had been overridden by freeze, but it hadn't completed, and so she can't move. And so then mobilizing the legs in a running pattern was just like mobilize, mobilize. And chit-chatting with her in a social way was like the little tease out of the freezy state. And the natural response then, of course, is going to be to re-feel the feeling that was too much. But now it's in a safer environment. She cries, and it's over. Her legs are mobilized. The flight in the sympathetic nervous system drains away, and boom, she was out. So completion in relation to trauma can be understood as like resolving those kinds of ancient impulses that are in us, you know? And you know the feeling, right? Like you get mad and you kind of want to punch something, but you're standing in line at the cheese board and the jazz band is playing and it's just not the right moment, even though you sometimes feel like this often in North Berkeley for strange reasons. You're like, I just want to punch something. And you're like, well, maybe I'll just get some pizza and, you know, everything will be fine, right? That impulse is an ancient self-protective impulse, right? And a different modality calls it your archaic wound, as in a whole bunch of those are all basically armor over this core, like, oh, whatever it is for you. You get in touch with that, you complete it, huge bodies of material from the past then resolve. So that's the trauma side. Basically, past danger and harm giving rise to present pain and distress. The other end of the spectrum is, I call privilege, where privilege is past safety and help. It's just its opposite. So safe situations and help given to you, support given to you. The word privilege arrived in force a bunch of years ago now in relation to kind of social justice action. And really has been valuable in identifying this aspects of the conditions that are carried into the present by folks of groups that are generally socially in power. So white folk generally, men folk generally, wealthy folk generally, and then, of course, in a complex intersectional system in ways that all of those are mixed for everyone, right? Privilege referring to past conditions that were safe and helpful, therefore the present moment symptom of comfort and ease. And the shadow then, and this is how it's mostly used nowadays in social justice conversations, the shadow of privilege being a kind of delusion or entitlement. You know, I was raised white by highly educated folks, seemed to be more or less straight growing up, therefore I got all the privileges according to those social groupings. You know? And central to the conversation on privilege is that it wasn't earned, right? So I didn't do anything particularly special. I just happened to have a male body to pass white, even though now when we look at photo light, I'm like, oh, I didn't actually, but no one told me I wasn't white, so I was therefore white, ish. But all that's a privilege, and using it in this way, I want to really emphasize that it's nobody's fault. It's you didn't earn it if you have it, to whatever degree you have it, you didn't earn it. But it's also not, it's not something to be ashamed of or a black mark on you. Here, in the way that I'm using it here, it's actually just a word for that aspect of the teaching on karma. And we all have a mix of all of them, right? In whatever ways you were harmed in the past and you still carry that now, call it trauma. In whatever way you were helped in the past and you still carry it now, call that privilege. And between the two, then, we have a framework for understanding the past. This is how we can sort of analyze the past. And then a framework for knowing how to practice with it in the present. Practice in the present in relation to the past, in general, we'll call healing. So if the healing trauma consists of completion and integration, healing privilege consists, it seems like, initially really in recognition of it. So very often, one of the symptoms of privilege is blindness to itself, because because pleasure is seductive. And so it's very easy to think that if I'm comfortable, this is not a special thing that I'm comfortable, but it's just the way things are or the way things should be. And the teaching on privilege says, no, you're comfortable because of conditions, because of certain conditions in your past that led to this. And therefore, you could be grateful for them rather than being deluded about them. You could also be sharp or wise in an analysis of them. You could understand them. So recognition. And then what do you do once you discover that you have some well-being? Basically, privilege or well-being means in some way you're suffering differently than others, but in a way that you might have a little more time or more resources to share. And so then service becomes one of the primary expressions of healing in relation to privilege. So if all of this is a way to talk about karma, and in a sense, I feel like this is actually just a very traditional kind of teaching on karma. It says the past has led to the present in the form of wholesome and unwholesome conditions. What happens in the present then is a series of states. I'm in a certain state. I'm in a state of joy or grief, of calm, of presence, of distraction. And the main thing that conditions those states is this mix from the past, of course, and the immediately preceding state. Like if I was happy a minute ago, it helps the possibility of my being happy in the present. Like the states have momentum. So the more you're grateful, the more you tend to be grateful. The more you're kind, the more you tend to be kind. The main thing that prevents us from being liberated is distraction, or the sense that the mind-heart is playing out patterns that are unwholesome, that I have no control over. And this leads to grasping, this leads to fear, this leads to resistance. All of the patterns that play out through us, we could even see them happening. I could even see myself in conversation with someone, I'm like, oh, look, I'm just grasping. I just want things to be this way or that way. I'm stuck. What if we say that all of this, all of the patterns that we find affecting our state in the present are all, in a certain way, conditioned? They are. The word would be sankhara or samskara. And they're all the result of karma. Your state right now is the result of your karma. Some good karma, some bad. That would be the old way to say it. Some privilege, some trauma. What happens once a trauma is resolved enough, integrated into my being, or when a privilege is seen enough that I'm no longer deluded about its effects? I think one of the things that happens is that it loses its charge, which means, in a certain way, it's not that I forget it. I might forget quite a lot of it, actually. But it's more like my mind doesn't need to go there, which is the same thing as forget, right? Like, it's not haunting me in the present. Forget is sort of negative, but, like, integrate is better. What happens when a certain thing in the past is resolved? When, like, oh my God, I was so bent out of shape about that thing for like a year, 10 years ago. But, you know, eventually I just forgave the person. I saw it with more wisdom, whatever happened. And now it just doesn't haunt me. And that's not the same as like I pushed it away and I refused to go there. It's actually like I could totally go there and I could tell you the story. And it would be even perhaps poignant or heartfelt or deep. But it wouldn't be gripping my life in the same way. In the very same way that I could say, I can tell you about how much I loved, like the Brahms Violin Concerto when I was 15. I loved it. Oh my gosh. Sent thrills of joy up my spine, along with Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, a great piece of Orientalist mush. I loved it. And I can tell you all about how great it made me feel, but I feel no ache to listen to it again. There's no urge to do that. What if that means, in relation to that thing, that small, meaningless bit of cultural, it's only meaningless if I say it's meaningless, it was important to me at one point. What if that's just gone? And what if that's liberation? Actually, I'm present and the past is what it was, but I'm not hooked. I'm not going to get reborn as a classical musician because the desire to be in it has left my being. What if that's true then about everything? Liberation means healing the past and then acting in the present based in that clarity. Here's a different way to say it. If all of the things from the past that wounded you resolved in your heart such that you didn't feel the pain or constriction on even on a subtle level, subtle levels of how you interact with people or how you bear the marks of your past, what if all of that could resolve in your heart such that the past would simply become the past? And you would understand how it worked, how situations led to other situations, led to others. This is an aspect of what I think is being talked about throughout the Buddhist tradition and many of the Hindu traditions after him, talking about the end of karma. We could say, oh, it's the end of continuing to accumulate the conditions for further distress or delusion. It's the end of being on the, it's resolving the trauma privilege spectrum in ourselves. If all of that disappeared, what would your present moment be like? There was no clench from the past. Who would you even be? It turns out that that's actually your identity, right? All that stuff accumulated. There's nothing else that's you in a singular way other than your story. You know, your history, the history of your body, the scars that you bear on all levels. And this is why liberation means the end of acting in ways that cause harm, the end of thinking you're a separate individual, the end of being reborn. Thoughts and feelings here. When you think about your own past in relation to this spectrum, you think about the process of resolving the past in this way.
I won't take up too much space because I got a lot of stuff, but I'm gonna
take up some space.
So I grasp this vis-a-vis past trauma and that framework.
Yep.
What about living in the time of trauma, living in a moment of climate anxiety, where people have a present and a future trauma, or they perceive that they do. This doesn't quite. Does this framework?
So here's, it's interesting, right? Okay, so here we are in the present, and everything the present is in all its complexity is the conditions for the future. The presence as an individual means, in terms of action, really only one thing, which is that you have access to volition. Basically, in the present, you're doing things, and you are only ever doing one of two things, basically. You're making a volitional choice, or you're acting on pattern. Habit, autopilot, whatever it is. You're acting from your conditioned momentum, or you're making a choice. The choice is also conditioned, but the mental quality of volition, or the heart quality of volition, the Pali word is chetana, is present. And so the presence or absence of volition is what creates karma. So that's a complex little hinge. But from the individual perspective, and again, there's these other perspectives that we've talked about, these rings going outward, but from the perspective of the individual, all you have in the present moment is the volitional options available to you in this exact moment. And if you're planning, if you're like, I'm going to do this for the next 10 years, that's just thought. And that could be a wholesome or unwholesome plan. But volition is like, you know, do I choose to do this thing in this moment or not? I have an impulse. Do I follow it or not? I want to bang my head against the wall because I'm frustrated. I could do it. I choose not to. That's a wholesome choice. And onward, you know. But that micro choice becomes part of the infinite web of conditions that conditions the next moment and the entirety of the future. This is why ending all of the patterns from the past puts one in, and so many of the sages describe this, puts one in a very mysterious state in the present, which is the state of being not subject to patterns. So then, like, what would it be like if you were just uninterruptedly mindful and present with absolutely no distraction, no thought, no drag from the past at all, and all that you had was this kind of very immediate sense of, like, this is what's happening, and this is what I can do in relation to it. This is what's happening, and this is what I can do. And from that state, first of all, that's a pretty peaceful state. Like, thought is the main thing that's not peaceful in us. Therefore, once that's gone, and I don't mean thought like no singular thoughts, I mean like habits and patterns, anxious, repetitive cogitation is the thing that's painful. In the absence of that, there's not much left. The great modern teacher, my teacher's teacher, Deepa Ma, she was asked, you know, what's your state of mind now? She hadn't done formal practice in years. She was an old lady, lived in Calcutta with her daughter. And her Western students came and asked her, like, what's your state of mind now? And she said, oh, there are three qualities present in my mind now. Loving kindness, concentration, and peace. Like, okay, that's very nice. I'll have that. Mm-hmm. Right? Basically, in the absence of anything else pushing her forward, there was just, so peacefulness is kind of like the end of any distress. Loving kindness appears to arise naturally in this state. It's kind of it's the emotional flavor of liberation, basically. Like, free people are kind. Because why would you be otherwise? And this is a longer conversation, but it hinges on, like, if karma is everything, then causing harm or not causing harm, in other words, contributing to trauma and privilege in the future, do you create danger and harm, or do you create safety and help? That's actually the only choice that matters. So in every single moment, even though the range of things one might do seems vast, the only thing that ends up mattering is, am I doing something that helps and creates safety, or harms and creates danger? And that's the action of enlightened beings, is you just start doing kindness. So the future doesn't exist, right? It's just thought. It will. And the process of conditionality simply says the future is what we make it, where the we is much faster than any of us as an individual. Therefore, my contribution to the future is actually pretty simple. You know, in whatever situation I find myself in, what's the best I can do, basically? And beyond that, you're just thinking. So that was the second insight of the Buddha's. So the first one is the past, the second one is the future. And the way it's literally spelled out, the first insight is like he sees all his past births. So that's understanding where I came from. The second one is he saw how beings pass on, arise and pass on in accordance with their actions. And so he really saw how, you know, exactly what one does in this moment creates where one goes in the future. And again, you could take that literally into multiple rebirths, or you could really just take it into, you know, what we say in the circle tonight affects how each of us goes home tonight, like the state of mind we go home with. And that affects how we speak to our people at home. And that affects how we get up in the morning. And it affects the work we are able to do tomorrow. And that's true on the micro and infinitely macro scale. So everything matters. Like, every tiniest choice matters. Which doesn't mean you should get all, like, rigid about it. It actually means that relaxing as a practice is very helpful. So...
It's wholesome.
Yeah. And I love this old word, wholesome. The Pali that it's a translation of is kusala. Kusala and akusala. It also gets translated as skillful. Skillful, unskillful, wholesome, unwholesome. But I love wholesome because it has a sense of... and again, if these words hadn't been so poisoned, one might say, by some other traditions, you know, I could just say good. Like, I like the word goodness, you know. Mm-hmm. Goodness and so that about future. It turns out that the hinge of the future is very tiny for us as individuals. It's just like, oh, how do I speak to this person right here? Yeah? Other thoughts? Any questions about practice?
Well, personally, since I've been here for a year and a half, and in between the first time I came with my son and then came by myself, I just thought I'll share with the group that I've been practicing the 20-minute sitting meditation, mm-hmm. and doing some reading, and I would compliment what we are being embraced with, which is our choice, our volition, our karma, with that understanding that our mind is serving our will, meaning that our mind doesn't, for me at least, doesn't run my day.
Mm-hmm.
And when I pay attention to that, I know that I'm living.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my mind doesn't run my day. May it be so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's some way that that's central to the whole practice, that there's, I have this habit of like one part of the web, you know, kind of dominates the whole thing. But it makes me want to make the sort of figure out what the right metaphor is to make a parallel between, you know, the kind of, you know, whether you put it in gendered or racial terms or you know, resource access terms in whatever way, but you know, the way that like the 1% dominates the resources of the entirety, sort of, let's say economically, right? Or you know, white men control more resources than they possess the demographic to do so, something like that, right? Right? Resources are unequally distributed. We could say, oh, maybe what if within my being the kind of the thinking mind is, you know, is the sort of 1%. That's the like, that's the part that should be part of the collective, but actually just pretends it's in charge and takes all the power for itself. So then if we actually had a, you know, a socialist revolution internally, we could say, you know, I'm sorry, you know, mind, but distributing the resources equally means that in this moment we're going to let the liver decide what to do next. And, you know, I'm actually going to let my heart talk right now rather than you, right? Or now I'm just going to listen to what the body has to say rather than you.
It's probably
leaps
off organic intelligence, does it?
There's very much a strong thread within organic intelligence of seeing if we can tune into the movement in the nervous system that's natural or autonomic, not cognitive. So tuning in, yeah, in a kind of bottom-up way rather than a top-down way. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So now I'm going to start, you know, somatic communism. It's not quite the right term.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else? Yeah. Thank you, Sean. Yeah, thank you.
Actually,
when
you were talking about liberation, had like a revelation from my own life. I immigrated to the United States when I was 23, and it was so painful that I think it was a really traumatic experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to go back, and I pretty much couldn't. But
mm-hmm.
My mom sold an apartment, so I won't come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no place to go, so I kind of had to make it through in the United States.
Yeah.
Kind of had no choice.
Yeah.
And looking back, I remember how much I wanted to go back and how uncomfortable I felt in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember when it disappeared, when it became my home.
Yeah.
And now, like, when I'm thinking about my original home, I'm having those like nice memories, but I don't long for it anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I'm at peace that it was part of my life, but not anymore. Like, I'm moving on, and I feel safe and comfortable here now. And I don't even know when it happened. When was a turning point or breakthrough moment that, you know, like I got liberated from a traumatic experience. But I remember it was pretty bad. It was, I don't know, maybe like 10 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
A long time. But once, like when you were talking about the, you know, liberation and not attachment, it just feels good.
Yeah.
It feels good.
Yeah.
Where, like, it's like you have so many experiences and you can go like, to this closet or to that closet. Mm-hmm. And you're like, it's all yours.
Yeah, right?
Like, my new jewelry, my new clothes.
Totally.
My
totally.
New shoes.
I mean, that's such a good metaphor. Like, there's totally stuff in my closet. I open it, I pull it out, I'm like, oh, that thing. I totally was into that. I totally wore that so much. And now I'm like, put it back. Like, it's like, oh, it's over. Whatever that. But it's still mine. It still has, like, you know, it's beautiful. But
yeah, that's like, it's nice, but like, I don't have that attachment anymore. It's
yeah.
Like the grasp and feeling that I want to go back.
Yep.
Well, it's nice, but, you know, like, I don't, like.
It's great. You're liberated in relation to it. And, like, what if that's it? You know, just that feeling. It's not even, like, it's not even a dramatic feeling in itself. It's more like the absence of dramatic feeling. You know, it's like, oh, it's just, it's like, yeah, I can think about it. That was nice. But it doesn't have that.
Pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is nice.
So. Beautiful. Thank you. Right on. All right. So, I believe 2 weeks from now is the 29th. Next week is like the 23rd or something like that. So next week, as usual, we'll talk about this more of this stuff. Maybe we'll look at the circles or something else. Continuing in this direction. 2 weeks from tonight is the great Buddhist holiday, Vesak or Wesak. And it's the celebration of the Buddha's birth and enlightenment and death, which, you know, just is fairly efficient.
Yeah.
Rather than scattering holidays throughout the whole year. So it's a big one. And there's also an enlightenment holiday in December, so there's one other. But traditionally what one would do would be, and now that I'm saying it, I'm like, we should totally do this, would be to bring a statue of the baby Buddha and to bathe it, to wash it, to celebrate its birth. But at the very least, we'll do a longer chanting puja and a celebration with a bit of a traditional kind of traditional, non-traditional celebration of Wesak 2 weeks from now. And we'll bring some snacks, we'll have a little snacky potluck for
vegan
food. Now I'd say in the modern contemporary East Bay, bring whatever is exciting to you.
Okay.
Yeah, anything. cool. And when we do that on the 29th, we'll send all the proceeds to my favorite Buddhist charity, which is Buddhist Global Relief. It was started by one of our great monks nowadays, Bhikkhu Bodhi, as a Buddhist faith-based action organization, orienting primarily toward hunger and women's rights throughout the world. So they're awesome. So thanks for being here. Thanks for offering your resources to support the group. Happy preparing for voting in the primaries. I haven't figured it out yet, but do your homework and vote. And I'll see you next week.